The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
We are live. All right, cool. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Harvest of Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and today we got another great guest to have a great conversation with, and I'm going to introduce them here in just a moment, but I'm going to give you a little bit of updates about what's going on sort of in my world, and then I'm going to let Corey pass on some updates, and we'll go there. So as far as me, for those that are watching, which is two individuals in this podcast, no one else is watching me. I'm like sunburnt from my eyes down. I spent a day on the water yesterday and got a good amount of sun while out fishing in the backcountry here in the Florida Keys. So great trip. I can't wait to share all the awesome content and recipes and food from that little excursion with you all, which will be coming up soon. I'll say sooner rather than later. I'm not going to give away dates or make promises, but it's coming down the road. Also, looking forward to spring bear coming up and the possibility of doing some spring turkey in Florida and maybe some other places. So we'll see. But that's quickly approaching us as the, I guess, quote-unquote thunder chicken season arrives. But yeah, Corey, what updates you got?
Not a whole lot going on here. I think our ice fishing season is pretty much over with. We actually went shed hunting after work and school today, and my wife was able to find a little one today, so first one of the season.
Oh, nice.
But now I'm going to start focusing on scouting for turkeys and start getting out there in the mornings and evenings, see if I can locate some flocks, so... Looking forward to that. Looking forward to the spring weather.
Yeah. What is it? Is it warming up there?
Yeah. We've been in like the 30s and 40s this week. So it's warm comparatively to what we've had.
Ooh, still cold. But all right. Well, do you want to talk about what's going on in the world of the Adventures for Food podcast?
We're still recording episodes. We have a bunch of recordings all lined up, and they are actually listeners. Harvesting the Wild Fishing Game podcast listeners have wrote in and said they had stories to tell. So I'm going to put the invite out to all the listeners that if you have a story to tell that you'd like to tell on the Adventures for Food series, please email whatscooking@harvestingnature.com. We'd love to hear your stories.
Yeah, absolutely. We love to hear them and share them too. If you think something's cool, something unique, it doesn't have to be a success story either. Like hunting and fishing stories, although many will say are weighed in success or failure, I think it's there's a lot of cool things to share out there no matter what the outcome is. So yeah. And I'll go ahead and plug our Facebook community page. Go over to Facebook and check that out. So it's the Wild Fishing Game Community. go ahead and join. And once you join, invite some folks to join too. Cool place to share tips, tricks, recipes, all that stuff, and interact with the Harvesting Nature crew pretty much on a day-to-day basis, actually. So, and also too, our friends over at Allen Company offered a great coupon for our listeners. So if you go over to their website, shop some great products. If you look in your closet or drawers, I'm almost certain you probably have something made by Allen Company already. Great products that are equally dependable. And click over to their website. Brand new website, looks great. And when you check out, punch in that Harvest10 code, and I'll give you 10% off your order.
Website is buyallen.com, BYALLEN.com.
There you go. buyallen.com. So, all right, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our guests so we can get into the meat of the conversation. So our guest today is a writer, hunter, angler, forager, and wild cook. He's been nominated for a James Beard Award for Best Web Series on Location and Visual and Technical Excellence for the series From the Wild, A Journey in Wild Food. Welcome, Kevin Coswin.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I hope I said that right.
You did, actually. Right on. Well done.
Woo! Nice. Thank you.
Good start. Good start.
Welcome to the Wild Fishing Game Podcast. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you spend most of your time, and kind of how you got into the outdoors.
Sure. Wow. I guess to kind of start a bit from the beginning, I do film for a living, so I actually work mostly in the world of food and pointing cameras at things. Lots of TV lately. We have got a show on PBS called Les Stroud's Wild Harvest with Les Stroud's Riverman guy and good friend of mine. And I've got From the Wild. So we've been, which is on network television in Canada. So I'm from Western Canada. I'm in Edmonton. We do most of our hunting, fishing, foraging in Western Canada. So I'm blessed to live in a spot where we have access to the boreal. In a couple of weeks, we're up in the Rockies, way up in the Rockies near Jasper, Banff, that kind of area. We hunt pronghorn in the grasslands, and we have badlands that look kind of like Utah. And then we've got the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Northwest to the west of us. So we do a lot of ocean foraging and fishing there too. So we have kind of, the more I've traveled for my work, the more I've realized we're really, really lucky to be where I am. I grew up hunting and fishing and foraging, grew up on moose meat primarily. And I would say that we picked mushrooms, we picked fruit, we hunted, but like one bird, we ate ruffed grouse, and one ungulate, we ate moose, and one berry, high bush cranberry or viburnum trilobum. And since then, I've ended up in this really unexpected career path of exploring the intersection of wild food and culinary, because I work a lot in the international culinary scene, I guess, with fairly posh chefs and Michelin starred and everything from kind of around the world. So we have culinary guests primarily. It's not so much about or ever about really hunting a trophy of any kind, other than the destination on our show is a plate of food. So that's kind of what I do and my background.
Cool. I think that's it's such an interesting way you put it at the end. I really like that. Like, the destination is the plate, which is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That really has been the guiding force behind what we've done. And for a few reasons, one of which is because we're in season 8 of the series right now. We started back up kind of when Meteor was being born. And before that, there wasn't really a lot of kind of culinary content in the world of hunting and fishing, especially, never mind foraging, which is still pretty niche. But there was kind of just a gaping hole in exploring what the kind of food potential was, because big game had been, for a lot of years, kind of, the cookery of it was pretty banal. And people like Hank Shaw, who started since I did, he's a food writer in California. There's just been a ton of people who've blown open kind of the food and wild food scene, which is great. But we were one of those people up in Canada doing the job here.
Awesome. I think it's cool. Yeah, we've had Hank on the show. We had some great conversations. Definitely like one of the, I would say in the States, one of the founding leaders of the wild food movements, and sort of getting a lot of people. I know his book was one of the first ones I ever purchased, which was cool. So it opened up a lot of gateway for many, many people.
Yeah, a fun fact of the day for that with Hank is that when I first started writing online about wild food, Hank was still a political journalist and was commenting on my blog back in the day. And I was encouraging him, like, dude, you know a lot about this. You should write about food. And so, ta-da, Hank's now. Hank has been on our show a few times too. So, and here he is well down a different career path, as am I. I'm formerly finance. I spent 14 wow. years in the world of finance. So
that's awesome, yeah.
Very different world, but fun one.
It's crazy. I love to hear people's stories. It's like everybody moves around until you sort of find a way to do what you really enjoy, which is awesome. So I want to talk a little bit about recipes. I admit that I've been stalking you a little bit on your Instagram, but there's some great content there. And I think Corey shared it with me first, was the your buck neck confit, the picture. So I kind of wanted to dive a little deeper into that and sort of hear your thoughts and ask some questions, of course.
Yeah, just as an intro, that dish, I'm glad you're into it because I was really proud of that one. You know, we do a lot of cookery in the field that is, I don't know, just more relatable and easy. And this one was a bit challenging in that I had shot a buck. It was a mature buck. We usually shoot younger age class animals, kind of have been arguing for years that in the world of agriculture, we eat young animals. And in the world of wild game, we tend to mm-hmm. harvest old animals and instead of selecting young ones, which are typically a better food outcome. Anyway, this year I'd shot a bigger, more mature whitetail buck. And in trying to decide what to do to, I guess, best represent that animal, I was also butchering a couple does, a mule doe and a whitetail doe, and realized that the neck size was a massively different factor on a buck. Last year, we boned out 22 pounds of boneless meat off of a mule deer neck, and a doe might have, I don't know, 2 to 3 pounds. So it's a huge difference. So I thought, well, I'm gonna do something with this neck. I'm gonna cook it low and slow, as one should do. And this buck also had a ton of fat on it. And so as Hank Shaw and I have discussed in the past, you should, you know, give it a warm up in a pan and smell it and make sure it's kind of got the flavor profile that you'll be happy with. And in this case, it did. And I had tons of it. Like I had, I filled a small, I guess a medium sized pot. So I probably had about 4 liters or a gallon of it. And, yeah. And so in went the neck, and I cooked it slow for hours and hours and hours until the meat was fork tender and pulling apart, and knew that the fail point in this idea was if I couldn't get the waxy fat off of it, that the mouthfeel would be mm-hmm. unpleasant. So the idea was to take it then and bring it to, we went and actually started a fire right where we harvested that deer in the bush, and then grilled that piece of neck, and it got really crispy, kind of potato chip crispy on the outside, and all the fat rendered off, and we pulled it and put it on top of a baked potato that was cooked in the fire with sour cream and pickled red onions and jalapenos and it was a killer dish, and it made me so happy that it actually turned out, because the concept really made sense technically. And sometimes those things mm-hmm. still fail despite, you know, making sense in your head. But in this case, it really, really, really worked. So it meant for me that whitetail fat isn't just bird food in the future, that whitetail fat can be, you know, put directly to use. Because if it is left on in your freezer, it is gross. After time, it goes rancid. And I'm particularly not a fan of rancid fat.
Yeah.
and so it's pretty perishable, as you know. So it means that the fat goes into a confit pot, and you confit the heck out of like neck cuts and shoulder cuts and shanks and whatever, and enjoy the heck out of that, because it's such a unique treat that I've never eaten that before.
I think it's great, because it's definitely like I wouldn't put it at the top for something that I would immediately think to do. You know, especially like you get in the. Yeah, you
right, get
in
the game of
like, all right, I'm processing, I'm prioritizing like what cuts I need to make, what needs to go where, what needs to get stored quickly or not stored quickly or aged, or you know, like the whole process. So I really respect sort of that out of the box thinking to do it quick and then make the decision to go with it. And I think it's a really good tip that you shared, and I hope the listeners caught it, but saying like taking the fat, putting it in a pan, warming it up, and giving it the smell test, and kind of, and that understands, or helps you understand sort of the relationship of how the flavor is going to come out from that fat.
Yeah. Yeah, that's important. And I think the same could be said for waterfowl, actually. I have the same approach for geese. But I guess kind of surprisingly, the flavor of deer fat is actually pretty pleasant. It's just when I think we often experience it mm-hmm. when it's off. And so that's kind of what's in our head is what deer fat should be. But when it's fresh, it's pretty great. But it does taste, it does have a mouthfeel of a candle. Let's make no mistake about that. You do have to figure out how to mitigate that.
I don't recommend it. Ice cream scooping it. Nope.
No.
Agreed. So do you think in the world of talking fats, and I spent a lot of time talking last episode recorded about fats, but do you think that as far as venison fat goes, that it's very diet based as far as the flavor and kind of what it comes out in your experience?
That's a good question. And I'm going to say, I don't know entirely. I mean, these deer were eating oats, at the time, you know, like would the fat taste different there? I've been to that field recently and they're not eating oats anymore. They're just browsing right now. So maybe the fat tastes different now if they're feeding on willow and the tops of fruit and hazelnut and that kind of stuff. So I don't know. It's a good question. As you know, with black bears, that's certainly a thing here. You pay attention mm-hmm. to that. But with deer, I'm not sure.
The approach and the thought behind what I was thinking is sort of, you know, in North America, there's the big debate of like mule deer versus white-tailed deer. So I kind of want to table that as far as like two types of deer, right? And I'm looking more at diet and the diet of white-tailed deer and even mule deer, I think, vary depending on the environment in which they inhabit. Like there's no doubt about that. Like they're going to eat different based on what's available to them. Like deer that eat off a cornfield, deer that eat off sage flats, or, you know, whatever food they have. And I don't know, I've been really into sort of trying to look more into how the diet of an animal affects the flavor. And it's something very, I find it interesting, but it's hard to pinpoint too, because there's so many variables too, like age plays into effect and all the other factors.
Mm-hmm. I could speak to that a little bit because we have a unique opportunity here in the world of white-tailed deer as an example. We harvest white-tailed deer in the grasslands, which is like flat prairie where there's actually bison and pronghorn. And then we mm-hmm. also harvest most of the deer that we shoot. The white-tails are up in the boreal forest where there's no crop. They're not feeding on agriculture at all. They're eating whatever's in the forest. That's it. And I mean forest for like hundreds of kilometers, and there's just nothing for agriculture. So I wouldn't say that I've seen a big flavor difference between those two locations. Like you say, there's other factors with age class and that kind of thing. But on the whole, I wouldn't say that white-tailed deer are as responsive to feed as say, like I mentioned, black bears, which absolutely are. And would be a completely, you know, you select where you're hunting those things for sure when you're talking about food.
Yep, absolutely. I'm excited to do my first, not my first black bear hunt, my first fully planned black bear hunt coming up in a couple months out in Oregon. So it's
all right on.
Yeah. Looking for some spring bears. Hopefully, hopefully the berries are in at the same time too. So I'm kind of looking to do a little pairing with that as well.
Cool. Yeah, we do. When we started the series, I was very averse to bear hunting. I'd never done it. I didn't want to point cameras at it and get crapped on by haters. So I just decided, no. And then got talked right into it. It's like, let's just have a look at what it's about. And so we got into two or three bears, I think, on that first hunt, and learned very quickly that they're quite a desirable food outcome. Actually, they're delicious eating. And ever since then, I think last spring we harvested four, and we harvest about 3-4 bears a year now, both spring and in the fall. So it's become a real staple for us, which was just not expected.
Yeah, I mean, the bear that I have had, I've had, you know, meat given to me by friends like from up in Alaska and stuff, and the meat's been phenomenal. And so I'm excited to go down that path. So
good. Enjoy the path.
We'll see. I don't know. I've heard some discouraging things from the as far as the terrain where we're going to be hunting at in Oregon, but that's okay. I'm up for a good challenge.
It's going to be hard, is it?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of verticals, and you know, I live right now on like a 3x5 island that's mostly flat. So we'll see. We get hit the Stairmaster.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Our next trip in a couple weeks is going into the way up into the Rockies, into a valley perched in the Rockies, and we have to climb a kilometer back and 900 feet of elevation just to get to our camp from where we're fishing for lake trout. So it's going to be a slog in, and there's still a lot like knee deep snow, and it's not warm. So it's going to be a thing, but it's okay. Wow. Those are fun adventures, man.
That's what makes it. That's what makes the, you know, sort of, you've got the two different parts of it, the food part and the adventure part for sure. And it helps add to both. Corey, do you have any questions about the confit as we were talking about it?
No, it looked like an amazing dish. So, you know, talking with you and Wade and Rachel, it gives me some confidence to try it on my own.
Good, do it.
Yeah, I think all these the conversations, and man, I hope the listeners are catching on to the same of like. This year I want to put a lot of attention into sort of testing and using and mess around with different game fats too. I think it's a cool adventure as well. So
one of the more unusual ones that we've used in the past with good success is actually moose bone marrow. That's one thing that we again put folded into quite a few dishes and over and over and over is just great. Really, really good.
So can you give me an example of how you incorporate that into a dish?
I can. We had a bear bratwurst for a culinary event that had moose marinades on it. So it was a mayonnaise made out of moose bone marrow. We've had like meatballs where the fat component of the ground moose was marrow, and they've had just like straight rendered marrow as cooking fat, like you would use butter or lard or mm-hmm. anything like that. So I've done a few different things. And like I said, every time it just kind of seems to work out. And the other one we use a ton of is black bear fat. So mm-hmm. that requires a good fall bear, but that's a treat too in the kitchen, as you know.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
So looking at some others, so I mentioned earlier, like before we started recording, pronghorn is definitely one of my favorite meat out there. And you affirmed that as well from your side, but,
correct. Yeah.
So, for any of those who are listening, go check out, Kevin's Instagram. There's a picture on there. I think like three or four lines down, you'll see it. It's pretty beautiful. And then you mentioned, I think it was the low bush cranberry or low bush cran as well in that dish.
Yeah. I don't know that was in that dish.
Maybe I was looking at,
but that was, one. Oh, there was low bush cranberry in the pronghorn burger. Yeah, there was.
Okay.
There was a low bush cranberry jam. Yeah.
So first off, standard burger, ground fat, all that other jazz.
Yeah, standard burger, except it was made by a guy who's on our team that is owns a slaughterhouse and has dealt with more meat than you or I ever will. He's killed 10,000-20,000 animals at the abattoir. And so he hand minced the pronghorn and Yeah, incorporated the fat, grilled it over some, actually the John, one of the guys on our crew, had made the mountain ash charcoal at his farm that it was grilled over. And on and on it went. So yeah, and the bun was made from corn that John had grown and corn pieces in it to give it some texture that we had picked from the ground where the mule deer were feeding out of cornfield they were feeding in and wrecking the farm. So we just kind of pulled all kinds of stuff together on that episode. And actually that same day I made a dish out of white fronted goose, and while we were shooting geese, we were picking the peas that the combine had left, and then a bunch of peas had sprouted. So we had like fresh pea pods and pea flowers and pea tendrils. And I cooked the yellow peas into like a mash and served it with white fronted goose. So that's kind of our jam, is taking, you know, what you find around you and kind of figuring out what the best culinary mm-hmm. use of it and getting it on a plate. So that was a bit of a highlight of season 7. That was a keeper, that one.
Yeah, that was a good one.
I love that everything's like full circle. The meat, the, you know, the deer are eating on the corn. You have the corn incorporated into the bun. I love how it's all just connected.
Yeah, and one of the things I try to encourage people, I teach foraging. I take people on foraging walks for plant and mushroom ID from May through October. And I'm usually preaching that we should kind of look at the stuff that's under our boots as food almost always. There's more species that are usable in the bush or in the wild than not. So we're kind of always looking to what's, you know, what's around and what does Mother Nature have on offer. We've kind of abandoned the going to a place and looking for a particular species. We'll still do that sometimes, but often, for example, our spring hunt has become, it was a spring bear hunt originally, but now the rabbit population is great. We're usually harvesting snowshoe hares. Last spring, we were harvesting horsetail and dandelion and fiddleheads and fireweed shoots and marsh marigold and on and on and on. And so it really has become ecosystem and seasonal driven harvesting, which I would encourage lots of people to kind of open their mind to, because sometimes you'll be failing, like we were on an elk hunt once, and find 40 pounds of mushrooms and shoot a bunch of grouse and just realize you have to stop and smell the roses and change gears and change the tack of your hunt and focus on what actually is there. So we've learned that lesson a bunch of times. So we really pay attention to that now.
I was watching the trailer to, I believe it was season 6, and the woman that you were interviewing, I can't remember her name, but she said, she, you know, talk about things, but those things are everywhere. Like, yeah, they're everywhere. Take advantage of them. So yeah, I like that mindset.
That was Lisa Cutcliffe from England. You should follow her too. She's Edulis Wild Foods in Leeds. And yeah, she was mentioning exactly that. We were picking nettles and she said people just ignore it because it's everywhere. But that's exactly why you should be eating that stuff, is because it's everywhere. So it's a philosophy that we carry it with us. It ends up in our show, but we also preach it pretty hard.
I think it's I like both those notes and thoughts of like, and I try to do the same. You know, I'll go out, identify like, hey, there's a primary species I want to go hunt, but it's like, what else is in season at the time? And like, am I going to have time to go fish? Or like, you know, do they have a lot of states here? Some have 2 or 3 day fishing license and some you have to buy the full license. So it's like, you know, what kind of commitment do I want to go through with that? Or if we're struggling with weather, fighting other things, it's like, if we have to choose between hunting or fishing, like usually we're going to lean towards the hunting side, just because. But
I have an example for you. You mentioned turkey hunting earlier, and we don't have, well, I shouldn't say that, but we have a very small population of wild turkeys in Alberta, so it's not something we really hunt here. We went and did that out east with a really well-known chef in Ontario. And we were after a turkey and weren't doing great at it, but in the meantime harvested probably $600 to $800 worth of chaga and maybe a couple $100 worth of morels and ramps and pheasant back mushrooms and violets and all kinds of stuff. It was crazy. And it really was, again, one of those moments where I thought, wow, we really were obsessing about the turkey when there's all kinds of other stuff around that we should probably pay attention to.
I've been in the same situation with a friend hunting spring gobbler, and we're hurry up and setting down, getting set up, and, you know, listening to the turkey gobble, and I look around, I'm like, I'm in all these wild ramps, and like I start digging them up and throwing them in my pack as we're trying to coax that turkey to come in. So
right on.
Yeah, that's a cool I can't say, I'm trying to think, I think more it's ended up with me like taking rabbit or squirrels, or like shifting gears into smaller game if I'm focusing on big. Or I mean, as far as like fishing wise, I've got a pretty tight knit group down here that we go fishing with, and some of the guys are pretty selective about the fish that they will keep. You know, we're talking saltwater fish, and I'm always the first one to be like, no, like we can use that, or, you know, yeah, that's not a trash fish. Like we should definitely be trying it out, or like we've caught it, the, you know, it swallowed the hook. Like let's keep it anyway and just give it a go and see if it's good. And, you know, through that, like, we've discovered we enjoy, as a family, some fish that other people were kind of quick to toss. And I'm like, man, you guys are missing out. It's just, you just got to be willing to jump out there and just give it a go. So,
heck yes. And same here.
Yeah. And I will caveat that though. And I will say that I've also tried some of those fish and they've been not good.
Fair enough.
But, I mean, that could be a fault of my own. Maybe I need to learn how to try to prepare them better. I think it's cool. Yeah. I'm digging it.
Yeah. And that humility will go a long way, man. I actually think that more often than not, that is the case, is just our lack of awareness on how to approach them in the mm-hmm. kitchen. And that's, again, that's kind of fundamentally what motivates me, is how do you, okay, fine. It's not an optimal food. It doesn't taste, it's not as tender as beef tenderloin. It doesn't taste like pronghorn, fine, but what could you do with it? What direction does it want to be taken, and what cultural lens might make that particular ingredient shine? So that's, again, the kind of questions we're asking.
You said cultural lens?
Yeah, we've had chefs, Amon Dasan, she's a British Indian chef, mm-hmm. so she brought Indian cuisine into the field with us, which brings a whole different layer of spices and flavors and technique. We've worked with a chef from Bahrain in the Middle East to bring Middle Eastern flavors to mule deer and sharp-tailed grouse and that kind of thing, that kind of beg for a little bit more of a flavor to go along with them, not to bury them. I prefer to think of, you know, spicing something more assertively as kind of meeting it where it's at, more than just burying it in flavor. So we've taken the wild foods, you know, thing into a few different cultural lenses, not just the Canadiana, Western Canadian, you know, food lens.
Cool. I definitely respect that. And I was thinking sort of in the same moment, as you mentioned, that is looking back sort of in my own errors with maybe not preparing fish, and then sort of a way to further learn from things that may or may not, is to look back at different cultures, to look back sort of any history and see how people were preparing, or if they were not preparing this fish, you know, a while ago, because I'm sure it's evolved. And as culture has evolved as a whole, like, we've dropped foods because we've got the availability of other foods. And so maybe finding an older recipe or something that mentions it, maybe a good direction to head.
Absolutely. Yes.
Do you have any other recipes that you're really, really digging right now that, or any that you're testing out, playing around with?
Well, I'm doing a ton of research right now on, I'm actually getting a sea kayak guiding designation, this summer. So I'll be doing a lot of, ocean. I'll be about a month on the ocean this year. And so that's kind of where a lot of my brain's at. But one of the recipes that's kind of coming up, I heard you guys talking about seasonality and being excited for spring and what spring brings. Mm-hmm. For me, in the spring, one of my favorite dishes to make is a chowder. And, we're usually eating chowder in spring bear camp or spring camp, because the day before spring bear season is ice fishing season close. So we're just sitting on all this fish, you know, canned and frozen and fresh and all pickled and you name it. So we're eating fish in camp, and so chowder usually is order of the day. Cream in camp is always welcome for the calorie boost. Fiddleheads and other greens will go into that. And one of the things that I love putting in that chowder is taking those lake fish that we have here and adding seaweeds from the West Coast into it to kind of give it that marine vibe. Which makes for one heck of a delicious chowder. So we've done that a bunch of times. That's something that I'll be looking forward to. Right now I've just been canning fish and, smoking fish, pickling fish. It's that season here. You guys are winding up on your, it's pretty funny to hear your guys' reality. We still have 3 feet of ice in the lake. So, we're not done fishing yet and we'll be on lake trout next. So that's what our next episode is. And that's still 2 weeks from now. Our prime time ice fishing is in March.
Okay.
And the lakes, ice is off the lakes in kind of late April, May, early May.
Nice. Wow. That's, I'm thinking like, obviously I'm in like the southern part of the United States, so it's a hard comparison for me for any of it.
Yeah, you are.
But I'm thinking like, man, it's already 81. It's in the 80s here, like steadily now. Our winter is very short-lived.
Yeah, and we're worried about freezing our butts off on this trip, even with winter gear, because it could be quite cold. So, yeah, ooh. It's, you know, it was 30 some below Celsius like 2 weeks ago here, maybe 35 below. Holy so it's smokes. It was proper cold recently.
Yeah, that is very, very cold. I don't want to get hung up because I'll get hung up talking about my disdain for the cold, but it's all right. So let's see. So let's talk a little bit about cooking in the outdoors was something we wanted to chat with you about, because I know you've got some camps and some educational opportunities set up here in the future, but I kind of want to pick your brain a little bit more about just cooking and moving, cooking over fire and moving in that direction. But, because I know there's a lot of elements that lead up to it, and one, I know not every fire is created equal, and I want to get sort of some thoughts from you as far as like woods that you prefer, or is it just anything available? What would you normally go route wise?
Interesting that you ask. Okay, well, the easiest way to answer this question is to kind of talk about how we teach this stuff, and why I teach this stuff. I have a busy film career, but there was a kind of a gaping hole in Canada, of this wild cookery, field cookery, kind of idea. And I visited a guy by the name of Nick Weston of Hunter Gatherer Cook in England. He's in Sussex and has an amazing, school that I was able to just go visit and hang out and film them, and got inspired to do something similar in Canada. So last year we ran our first year of courses, and we'll be doing it again. I teach foraging walks, but our big, huge, long workshop day, I teach people how to cook out of a backpack. So basically like light kit bush cookers, the little guys, the little secondary gas burner type little bush buddy stove things, how to cook out of those, use like the little isobutane stoves. And again, just kind of light cookery. You're out for the day, hiking, fishing, whatever. How do you make some decent food that wraps in some of the stuff that's in your environment, and make a quick, good meal that's connected to that place and that time? So that's one part of what we teach. Then it goes into our base camp in that space, which has a chef there and our culinary team, and we'll run, I guess 5 courses for them with, foraged tea pairings and like, foraged cocktails and stuff. And then, in that we teach pantry building and fire cookery in a base camp, because when you're base camp cooking, you have opportunities to use things like, you know, like a piece of grill or a permanent piece of structure, like a rocket stove, or, build a tripod and swing a cast iron, Dutch oven for a few hours to braise some meat, that kind of stuff. So, in that location, we have, to answer your question very indirectly, we have what I call a wood library. It's a gigantic round wood timber woodshed that has kind of columns in it. And there's a really good picture of it at fromthewild.ca on Instagram. But it's columns of different species of wood, so that the chefs that are in camp have an opportunity to cook with either tamarack or white birch or spruce or alder or aspen or whatever. And then we have various smoking woods in there too. So It's with the intent of the idea of reconnecting people with this idea that firewood's not just this neutral thing like propane in a tank on your gas barbecue. They all have different properties burning wise, but they also have different properties flavor and aroma wise. And I would say that people up in Canada have a propensity to be using woods that you guys use down in the States, like hickory and mesquite and that kind of thing, to smoke. But we don't have those woods here. That has nothing to do with the forest here. So we're trying to encourage people to use, you know, the nut woods and the berry woods and stuff like alder that really does impart beautiful flavor to food. So that's kind of what I teach and how we approach wood at that camp.
Nice. So you mentioned sort of equipment-wise, having a fixed object if you're cooking out of a base camp. I guess without going too much into, I want people to go attend your classes, not listen to the podcast and get all the goodies for sure.
No, that's fine. Yeah. It's okay. People that come to the advance are just live around here, so it's not. It's cool. I don't think you're gonna ruin my market.
Awesome.
Happy to share.
As far as like cooking over the fire, looking at special equipment wise, could you sort of give kind of a range from like the easiest to use to like something more complex that you would use, like you mentioned sort of tossing a grate using a rock versus like setting up a tripod to put a Dutch oven over, like what?
Yeah, I can do this. Simple example. When Hank Shaw was on in season 3, and he does not cook over fire a lot, 'cause as he mentioned, he lives in California. You don't start fires on purpose there, is how he put it.
Nope.
So he loved it, but I gave him a chunk of rock. And he grilled goose breast and ruffed grouse whole skin on a chunk of slab of rock I'd brought from the Rockies and stuck on the fire. So there's basic. And I would say that one of the advantages of rocks around a campfire is they're great for baking potatoes and they're great for like roasting sausages, because you don't have any mess. You don't need a grill. You don't need anything. You just put the sausages around your fire and leave them on the rocks. And to clean up the fat and stuff, you kick the rocks into the coals when you're done. I'm a big fan of that style of cookery, and we, for the most part, use sticks and really boring technology because they just work so darn well for most cooking things. And on the complex side, when we had an Indian chef come in, she had requested that we make a tandoor, or asked if it was possible. So we actually built a tandoor out of mud and fire bricks and stuff, so that she could make naan in the bush. And so that would be on the more complex side. And that would kind of be related to, I've built quite a few cob ovens or earth ovens. And those are a good example of if you frequent the same place over and over and over, and you've got clay or rock or stone in the area, you can build permanent structures like ovens in those spaces. So right now we rely heavily on rocket stoves. And I would really recommend looking that up if you want kind of a fuel efficient, tidy, nice, fire safe way to cook in the forest at a base camp. Like a brick rocket stove is a really great option. And again, our Instagram's got photos of that. We cook with it a lot.
Cool. So let's, I guess, talk as far as like what to do and what not to do when approaching cooking. Like, what are some definite no-nos that you would tell people? Like, obviously, a prime example is like with Hank Shaw, like we don't start fires in California on purpose. So kind of moving those out, any tips or tricks that you would share?
Well, yeah, I mean, that basic fire safety one, I know you want to dodge it, but it's actually really super important. Mm-hmm. Only in that you have to be prepared accordingly in case there's a fire ban here. That's for sure a thing, especially in the spring. It can get dry in May here when we're in the bush. So there's a very decent chance that when you go out, you won't even be able to start a fire. So if your entire plan's built around fire cookery, you better have a backup plan. So that's kind of step one. Other than that, it's kind of simple stuff, like have multiple skills to start a fire, because I've been in the field many times with very competent people where starting a fire has been a major problem because it just poured rain and everything is soaked. You're surrounded by hundreds of kilometers of trees and forest and timber and everything, but it's all wet to the point where you just cannot start it. So I have a fire kit that's got dry birch bark in it all the time. Everywhere I go, doesn't matter what kind of thing, because I've just been on the wrong end of it too many times. Have other skills if your lighter doesn't work or your ferro rod's lost or broken or whatever. So we've done an episode where we went winter camping in middle of February. You wouldn't want to go on that when it was like really cold. The trees were popping in the cold. And we didn't bring a lighter. We didn't bring anything. We skidooed in and then we parked the sled got stuck in a snowbank. So we snowshoed back into this birch forest and we found some chaga and got some cattail and hand drilled a fire. So while that's not something you need to know how to do all the time, those are handy skills to be able to at least have in your head if you get stuck and need to get out of a bind. Now, beyond that, I would say that the simple cookery that people do on fire is generally going to be centered around meat cookery. And if we're talking specifically around meat cookery, my best advice I can give you is make sure that you temper your meat. Okay, maybe two or three key points here. You temper your meat before. It's a culinary term for letting things warm up. Mm-hmm. You do not want ice cold or cold meat going onto a grill. Don't cook it. We've got this idea that we have to sear red meat all the time. That is not necessarily the case. Cook it, go easy, go on medium heat. And then let it rest. Once you've got it to a doneness with your finger that you're happy. I know people make fun of all these steps, but especially resting, it's like it's voodoo or something. People just really resist this idea of resting meat, but it is a thing. It's one of the reasons why you go to fancy restaurants and their meat's doneness is impeccably perfect. It's because they actually pay attention to these fundamentals of don't cook your meat ice cold, cook it mm-hmm. good and slow and just be really attentive to it and then let it rest. Those are things people really, really, really get wrong. And lastly, I'd say around fire cookery is meal planning is usually something people screw up pretty hard and don't think about. They usually think about stuff that can go into pots and pans and make a gigantic mess. And they don't usually think about things that are maybe grilled that don't make a mess, like skewered vegetables and a steak. I'll sign up for dishes on that in the field. But I've had people make, you know, multiple sauces and panned fried meats and then bacon and stuff. It's just a gigantic disaster of cleanup in a place that's very difficult to do cleanup. And sometimes water is scarce. So I'd really recommend planning your menu to begin with around the type of fire cookery that you're going to be doing to make your life easy. And I don't mean to be lazy, be smart, mm-hmm. but you can be smart and also adapt to the working space or the constraints that you're going to have in the field.
Yeah, we had to pull a quick change in plans the other day when we were going out to film and we had to shuffle from actually a plan to cook over the fire to using a camp stove to cook with. And so, you know, we quickly changed and it also turned into like, well, now the camp stove kind of opens up the opportunity. And then my mind started going down this rabbit hole of like, I can make some elaborate sauces and all this. And then like, well, then I'm carrying like a plastic tote of utensils and pots and pans on a boat. And I'm like, no, this is not where I need to be. And so I brought it back and found a very simple, straightforward sauce to just pair with the fish. And that was it. And I was like, guys, we're just going to eat fish and a few sauteed vegetables, everything out of one pan. And that's it. And they're like, awesome. And I went out on a limb with the sauce and it came out great. And I was super, super pleased. So
right on. What was it? What was the sauce?
So I took a rum. I took Cuban rum and sauteed garlic and onion in butter, poured the rum, which I'd also mixed with some honey, and then put lime in there too.
Nice. Got sweet, you got acid.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, and it was proportionate enough because I was really nervous that, you know, you think rum and honey and butter, you're like, oh, that's the perfect dessert sauce. And I was like, there's gotta be I'm gonna try to use the lime to sort of to cut the sweet and just add another element of depth in there. And it with the fish we prepared, it just came through like amazingly. So it's pretty
right on, well done.
Yeah, thanks. Well, let's see, Corey, you had a question. I see a note on here.
Well, I want to talk about his favorite. I want to talk about Kevin's favorite meals or dishes over the fire. Cook over the fire quite a bit. So I want to know the best ones, your favorite ones.
Okay.
That's a tricky one. Oh, boy. Yeah, I think technical accomplishment wise, like some of the fussiest stuff I've seen, that's really hard to do. I think I mentioned Hank Shaw and that, you know, just plucking a grouse to begin with, and to keep the skin intact. He's very good at that, and that's hard to do. And then roasting that bird whole over a rock, and then getting the doneness inside perfect and the skin crispy. Try that. That's not easy to do. And it's delicious when you're in the field, you want to eat that. Okay, one of my favorite seasonal things, I'm gonna let myself be guided by that. I mentioned the chowder in the spring. In the fall and September, one of my favorite things to eat cooked over fire in our camp is the first ruffed grouse of the season with shaggy mane mushrooms and cream and garlic. Ooh. That's one thing that just kind of, I don't eat it any other time of year. It's just that one moment, and I just love it. I would also say fire. I just can't help but think of smoke. I just spent a fair amount of time. I had a lake trout from the Northwest Territories that was, I guess, 15, 16 pounds, and smoked half of it. And delicious. Like, smoking things in the field is, again, something I don't think we think enough about when we think about cooking over fire. Smoke is such a critical component of that. And it can be a bit tricky to get smoke to show up because your clothes are covered in smoke and your hair smells like smoke, and it's hard to actually taste it in your food. But I would say that, you know, give smoking food some thought. Other favorites over fire. Man, we do it so much, it's hard to even peg what, which ones would be even cooked over fire. I'll pick one from our field cookery camps last year. Cooked over fire. Oh, well, and this kind of comes with a lesson. We had an elk braise in Dutch ovens. We were feeding 16 people and had two Dutch ovens full of elk shoulder. And learned from the chef that time around, and the elk shoulder turned out perfect, and it was bubbling hard. And I thought, yeah, this is going to be some boiled meat. And it was actually excellent. And the lesson of the day from the chef was that water only gets to a certain temperature. So as long as you keep a braise fully hydrated, that your meat doneness will be, or your meat texture will be spot on every time. As soon as you let that water get out of that braise, if it's bucking pretty hard, then that's when you fail. So that would be kind of like a highlight from last fall. So I don't know. I mean, on and on and on, on it goes. We do a lot of fire cookery, so I'll have to leave it there.
And in one of your Instagram posts, you had a hike-in dining table. So elaborate on that a little bit.
Yeah, when we built the field cookery camp that we teach, when I bought that land, we had talked about putting a parking lot in there and a gravel driveway and stuff, and just decided, forget that. Like, I'm going to pave paradise here. And so we'll just leave it as you just walk in. So we have a really solid, well-equipped kitchen for a bush kitchen that you have to walk. You have to get in on your boots. There has never been a quad or a truck or a nothing that has been in there. It's all, every piece of lumber and timber and tree and nail and screw and plate and everything has been hauled in by yours truly. And so the folks have to actually hike into this table before they can sit down and taste the things that come from that forest. So the idea was, and I guess the context is that I've spent the better part of a decade pointing cameras at the local food movement and farm to table dinners and all manner of kind of the deeper exploration of that into the world of wild foods and people trying to make really cool culinary activations and experiences. And often they fall short because for a variety of reasons, let's just put it that way. And often it's because there's a disconnect with actual hunting and fishing and foraging and the culinary space. They kind of live in very separate worlds most of the time, other than for some chefs not, but for the most part, yes. So I decided that I don't want, you know, tourists and food writers from Germany and Holland, who I do have on my events, coming and going to an event where they pretend they're under the stars. I want them to actually be under the stars, and I don't want them to, you know, pretend to eat food from that area in the forest. I want them to actually be in the forest and smell the forest. And the dining room's actually set in on the top of the hill, and the whole hill's covered in hazelnut and blueberries. So our first, you know, dessert was a blueberry. Oh, it was actually a corn ice cream, but with blueberry, cooked blueberries and hazelnut pralines. So we're really folding the ingredients that are, that surround that table into the menu. So that was the idea. And, while COVID has meant that culinary activations are very much not so much a thing right at the moment, our field cookery camps have proceeded, but kind of our long table dinner plans that we had originally thought of doing there have been abandoned, and I don't even want to do them anymore. Our field cookery camps are great, and we have great people out there, and I want to keep it that way. So so that's what we do. It's a table that can accommodate 40 in the middle of a forest that you have to walk in and get on your boots and get in there, or you just don't get to eat there.
That's awesome. We participated in a similar event. I'm trying to think. Is it Outstanding in the Field? I think is one of the companies that runs here in the States. They came down to the Florida Keys and did sort of a Florida Keys special where we worked with some of the local lobstermen, some of the shrimp and fishermen. Actually, one of them we had on the podcast in our very first season. He was one of the few people in the Florida Keys that has a commercial spearfishing operation. So that was pretty neat to learn about that, and then later sort of connect all the dots together.
Very cool.
And we were, my wife and I at the time owned a hydroponic vegetable farm down here in Key West, and we provided the greens and stuff for it. So it was a wonderful event, but it opened my eyes to sort of those long table style dinners, and I really, really appreciate those. They're so much fun.
Yeah, they are. And it's something that I'm sure will be back once things are back to normal. So
yeah,
normal-ish, whatever that is. Yeah.
whatever it's going to be in the future. Could you talk a little bit about the web series From the Wild? To give us a little, I know we've mentioned it several times and you've alluded to it, but sort of maybe a little more detail I think the listeners would enjoy.
Yeah, From the Wild was, at the time I started it, I was working a lot in agriculture and the local food kind of space, slow food here. And at the time, there was a gaping hole in, as I mentioned, in the world of kind of like culinary food and wild things. So started the series, again, I mentioned we're in season 8 now, so started way back when, a number of years ago. And the premise is pretty simple. We go throughout all the seasons. So we are in the winter, spring, summer, and fall, looking for, you know, anything basically in various ecosystems that we can explore culinarily. So the end destination is always a plate of food or multiple, depending on how many chefs we have and how long we're out in the field. But it's pretty much that simple. We've certainly learned a heap along the way, and I would say that the whole project has been a very personal journey. It's almost diary-esque. It's definitely not prescriptive. It's not like, here's how you hunt and here's how you cook food. It's really more just watching me and all my food industry friends kind of figure shit out and go, okay, well, we don't know what to do with this, but I kind of know what it tastes like because I just put it in my mouth, and I have some ideas what that kind of tastes like and reminds me of and what works in that space, and then combining flavors and ideas and coming up with something that really speaks to the time that we have out in the field together with our friends. So that's what the series is about. It covers everything from ice fishing to spring bear, as we mentioned, and foraging. Lots of fruit, lots of berries, lots of greens and mushrooms. We've done a lot of mixology in season 7, so lots of cocktail stuff. And lots of big game hunting. So I think in season 4, I was just cutting it because it had to be released for television here. And I think at the close of season 4, we had harvested 18 big game animals between 2 or 3 guys. So we do a lot of big game hunting and live in a place where you can get a lot of tags. So we definitely have done our share of that in the last number of years. So this year, a bit of a pivot. We're doing I'm doing a lot more ocean episodes. So probably do 4 or 5 out of 10 that are actually out of the ocean. And kind of the big kudos, as you mentioned, we had a James Beard nomination, which is a big deal in the United States.
Yeah, congrats. Congrats for that. That's huge.
To be a Canadian there is quite something. And then the last time I was there in New York, I was up against Chef's Table from Netflix and CNN's Parts Unknown with Bourdain. So there was the three of us there. So that's pretty big names to be, pretty big company. So that was a huge honor. And it's, yeah, and just kind of plugging forward, man. It's been a pay-per-view series since day one. And I've kind of reveled in keeping it there in that we've had no censorship, no sponsorship, no nothing. We just really could roll our own, show the side of food that's kind of ugly sometimes, like gutting and blood and guts and nasty stuff that no broadcaster at the time would have anything to do with, and really have kind of genuine conversations around food and kind of pick up the story where a lot of hunting shows and fishing shows had left off, which is like, here's the fish, here's the rack of the buck I shot. And leaving food people thinking, yeah, but then what? Mm-hmm. Then what happened? And you don't get to see that ever. And in this season seven, I mean, I'm like shoulder deep gutting animals like over and over and over and over and over. It's just part of the show and part of the process. So again, that kind of uncensored approach has been really, really helpful for keeping us creatively on track. And I think creating some good content that's pretty unique.
I think that's awesome too. And to have the freedom of creativity, I think speaks to it. Cause, it's unfortunate a lot of times when sponsors and other things start coming in and start to kind of alter content, especially in the world where, you know, hunting and fishing meet, and, you know, there's the connection to the dirty bits, the parts that make people uncomfortable. And some people don't want to, you know, support that because they may be part of that population. And I mean, if people get uneasy around it, it's okay, but it's still part of the process. Like, so I respect your incorporation.
Yeah, as it is in the world of agriculture. So I think hiding from that is being really naive and is a kind of a cultural deficit. It's not to our advantage to not be aware of how animals are handled before we eat them as food. If there's any relationship with any food that we should have the most connection to and the most awareness around, it should be the animals that we kill to eat. So it's been really important to us from day one.
Awesome. Well, what's the as far as getting into the pay-per-view and watching it, where should people go to see it, the series?
All of it's streamed through Vimeo. They handle all the distribution. So the easiest way to track us down is fromthewild.ca. That's our website. And it's got, all of our seasons are just linked through very simple buttons through to all the different season pages for season 1 through 6. We're about to release season 7 in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And we're starting to shoot season 8 right away. So,
nice.
Fromthewild.ca.
Nice. And we'll throw the link in the show notes as well, as always. And then, as far as people connecting with you, if they want to follow your journey in this journey and, maybe if they have questions or interested in field cookery or anything like that, what's a good way to connect with you?
I'm pretty active on Instagram, at fromthewildca is our Instagram account. I'm at Kevin Coswin on Instagram, and happy to engage there, answer questions there, and and the people can follow there. That's probably the easiest. We're also on Facebook, and all the social media handles are you can find through From the Wild.
Sweet. All right. Well, we're kind of coming to the end of the conversation here, and we always have sort of a chance for misfires, alibis, or last notes. Any last thoughts that you may have for us or for the guests, please feel free to share.
Okay, I have a question for you, Mr. Florida.
Uh-oh.
What's kind of the cultural norm down there for fire cookery? I mean, I know what it is here, and I'm very familiar with it here, but I have no idea how you would barbecue or grill in your backyard. Is it hardwood charcoal or propane? And when you have campfires, what do you burn and what do you smoke with? Stuff like that.
So it's a very good question. I'll lead off with telling you that I've only been here in California. I've only been here in Florida for about 5 years. Prior to that, I was in California, and I'm originally from Oklahoma. But as far as where I live in the Florida Keys, and it's very restrictive on where you can and can't have campfires when you're out, because it's a lot of national preserves, and like we have the Great White Herring Reserve and the Florida Keys Bird Sanctuary, I think is the full name, but it kind of encompasses the majority of it. But as you get up into the regular part of Florida and start to interact in normal, I'll be really honest as far as like I don't know a lot about the traditions with over the fire cooking within Florida. And man, it's a good point for me for some homework for sure. just thinking like the times that I've gone out, we haven't, cause it's off, it's very wet here, the majority of the time, and humid and rains off and on. So we often take firewood with us, versus going out and getting it. So that sort of play into that element of not, but, I mean, you have palm here. I wouldn't say palms would be a good wood to cook over. And then the Everglades is a pretty unique ecosystem with what's available there. You have different oaks and other types of trees, pines and other as well, too. So I don't know. It's a piece of homework for me for sure.
Do you have hardwoods down there?
We do have hardwoods, yeah.
Okay.
Not as much in the Florida Keys. Like, we do get some. So down here, they get little strips of tree areas called hammocks, is basically they would classify as, because the salinity in the soil in the Florida Keys is very high, and it's a lot of like mixed coral rock and stuff. So it's hard. There's only a select number of plants that can grow here. As you get up into main parts of Florida, like obviously the ecosystems change and soil types are very productive and good for growth. But yeah, there's hardwoods in throughout Florida, not as much in the Keys though.
Interesting. So smoking, what would you guys smoke with? What kind of wood?
I like a lot of the fruit woods. So I try to get my hands on just about any fruit wood that I can. I know that we will get like apple and stuff brought in. I haven't played around as much with some of the tropical woods, tropical fruit woods, but I should more.
Interesting. I mean, I live in a place, the boreal forest, where it starts. It goes for, I would have to drive for 14 hours before, maybe 16, before I hit like Yellowknife. And that's where the boreal forest starts to end and the tundra begins. So we're talking like, I don't know, 1,000 miles of forest.
Wow.
And we can have fires anywhere, any in that space. And we're the northern, yeah, we're the largest northernmost city in North America, in Edmonton. So there's really nothing north or east or west of us that's bigger. So being able to burn stuff here and have fires is pretty, I take it for granted. Let's just say that. And I do find it interesting when you have different, entirely different plants, like where you live. Sounds fascinating. Like that's totally different than where I live. So, and that's the beauty of it, man. So you come visit me and I have completely different things that, you know, our foods would taste different based on how we burn stuff, which I think is just fascinating. And part of the discussion, by the way, of foraging in general, because foraging, I think when you talk about foraging, people think of berries like blueberries and morels, but foraging to me means everything from tree sap to firewood, to, you know, to greens, salad greens, cooked greens, you name it. Foraging is pretty broad, and firewood is just part of the foraging spectrum. So anyway, just obviously keenly interested. I could listen to you talk about Florida all day because it's such a different planet. Oh, and our show Wild Harvest is in Florida, by the way, on the PBS station. Florida is one of the places that was the most supportive of the show early on, the PBS stations down there. So Les Stroud's Wild Harvest is for sure on PBS in Florida.
Oh yeah, awesome. We'll make sure we put some notes in there about that as well. Cool. Well, Cord, do you have a last comment or note?
Thank you, Kevin, for coming on and talking with us. I think it's been a great conversation. I always love talking about food. So
yeah, no problem, man. Me too. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you coming on. It was an awesome conversation. And like you said, I could continue talking. I try to picture a lot of the environment of where you live in the forest and just being out and surrounded completely by trees and just doing a whole over the fire cooking, and just it gets me excited. So I think I'm ready to head back north a little bit and spend more time in the woods versus on the islands. So there's more to come on that. But for everybody else out there, thanks for listening. And as always, our show notes will be online. And you'll make sure you're following Kevin on social media. Go check out his profiles. And go check out From the Wild, too. Pretty interesting show, pretty interesting idea, and take a journey to the plate, which is cool. So outside of that, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast and punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, tell us what we're doing wrong, or tell us what we're doing right. And we thank everybody, and have a good night.
A life that has the stories to back it. A life to be proud of. It's a Winchester life.
Yeah, baby. 6'8 Western. Oh, mule deer, baby, right there.
Tune in every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne?
Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.